Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Provention Connection web conference call. Currently, all participants are in a listen-only mode, as later we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Just as a reminder, this call is being recorded, and at this time, I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. David Lee. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and welcome to today's Provention Connection web conference, "TERF is Not a Four-Letter Word: Advancing Violence Against Women Partnerships." I'm glad to have so many of you online for this call, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to write that line on the screen. Provention Connection is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I want to be able to highlight that if you want to be able to reach us, these are the numbers that we can be reached. We have our 800 number, 888-922-5227, and we also have other numbers for information that Chad Sniffen and myself are your primary contacts, and do feel free to email us at the addresses that you see on your screen. So these are the two different email addresses. Provention Connection, as on our website at www.preventconnect, has a wide variety of instruments and tools that can be available to advance primary prevention of violence against women. I encourage you to visit the website to learn more about our podcasts, about our online presentations, and also the Provention Connection Wiki. The Provention Connection Wiki is a lot like Wikipedia, but it's dedicated only to violence against women prevention topics. And by entering this, we can bring in the knowledge of the field. So for example, on the Prevent Connect listserv, there was a discussion of posters. We now can summarize that conversation and put information about that on the Wiki, collecting the knowledge of people from the field. On our listserv, on our website, you also can sign up for the listserv, which is a wonderful resource of 900 prevention educators throughout the country dedicated to the conversation about what violence against women is. You can also sign up for web conferences like Provention Connection, like what you're on now, and we also can be able to have reading clubs, which we will be having sending people announcements for. A reading club is a small web conference of about 10 to 15 people where we take a recent publication about violence against women and we discuss it and talk about its implications to primary prevention. You'll be seeing announcements about upcoming reading clubs soon. Also on our website, we do have the materials and our archives of our previous events. So I encourage you to be able to visit the website.
I'm going to spend money I don't have. How do you have a
deficit? Hi, I'm sorry. I'm hearing someone's voice. So and all participants should be on mute, but please be careful. We have an upcoming web conference. Our next web conference is going to be called Advancing Primary Prevention Partnerships, Challenges and Opportunities for Working Within Service Delivery Organizations. This will be held on July 10th, 2008. Also, just so you are aware, we are looking at doing an encore performance of this web conference about TERF, since so many people could not get in. And this web conference will probably be held at the end of June, and we'll have different guests talking about different TERF issues. So announcements will be sent to everyone who is registered to this web conference, so you can refer others to be able to attend that session. I do want to alert you on how to be able to use this technology. Several people are asking about being able to mute. You do not need to worry about muting your phones. All participants' phones are already on mute. On your left-hand side of your screen, you will see a bar very similar to what appears on this slide. In there, one of the features that you can use, that we will use, is our hand raise function, which appears above my picture. I have circled it here. Please, everyone, raise your hand. And we can hear lots of sounds of people as they raise their hands. I can see that. So go ahead, raise your hands. And I see that people are doing this. This will be a way that we will be asking for information from you throughout the day. Another feature that we will be using, that we use, is called our questions and answers. And this is a way we can find out information about you. And for some reason, the Q&A is, I need to be able to add this here. The system did lose it in here. So we will, I will come to that in a minute as we can be able to talk about ways that we can learn more about the audience and what features are here in Prevention Connection. For Prevention Connection, so let me close this and move on. We also have our text chat. Many of you have written in the text chat to be able to learn ways that we can communicate with each other. This is a way that you can be able to learn from and share ideas. The text chat window appears on your left-hand side of the screen. That is a very small window. If you want to make that a larger window, click on the box in the far right-hand corner, and that will expand your box, chat box, and make it easier to be able to read. So that is another feature that you can be able to do to be able to join our web conferences and be able to participate with each other. What I'd like to do is now add some it looks like my questions have disappeared from the system, so I will not do them. Let's just get a sense from you in the audience. If this is your first Prevention Connection web conference, please raise your hand. Go ahead and keep on raising your hand. I see that about 40, 41, 40 of you have raised your hands. That's great. So we have about a large number of our audience who are first-time participants. I want to get a little bit of a sense of how many people are. Can you go into the text chat and write if you are what type of organization you are, so we can get a feel of what type of organizations? Are you a rape crisis center? Are you a domestic violence agency? Are you a public health department? Are you at the university? This is going to go really fast. Coalition, we can see government services, dual attorney general, dual rape crisis center, state coalitions, university police I saw. This is flying by. This is great. Fatherhood collaborative, sexual violence coalition, a prevention organization in Montana, coalition, differential response from a community-based organization, university health promotion. This is really helpful to get a sense of the wide range of people who are participating on the call, and it's really great to be able to learn about who's in our audience. Also, you will see PowerPoint. We also have PowerPoint slides that you are seeing here. To get copies of the slides, these are available on preventconnect.org. We have them both as one per screen and also handouts of three per screen, so you can be able to reference them. We also will record this session and paste and place it on the web conference after the session. Just from technology, if you have some challenges and questions, you can always send us a text chat, private text chat by on the bottom box where it says who to send it to, and we'd be able to answer your question there. You also can call iLink Technical Assistance at 800-799-4510, or you can call CalCASA at 888-922-5227, and Chad would be there to be able to answer your questions. In Prevention Connection, we talk about violence against women, and we define this in a broad way, looking at both domestic violence and sexual violence, and looking at life violence across the lifespan. At Prevention Connection, we're looking to prevent before violence begins in the first place, and we're looking to make connections to other forms of violence and other social issues. I encourage you to be able to join with other Centers for Disease Control, national resource centers on this issue, including the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, the National Youth Violence Prevention Resource Center, and VAWNET, the National Online Resource Center. I also encourage you, as you will see our presenters today from Prevention Institute, all provide important, valuable information. Prevention Connection is sponsored by the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views and information provided in this web conference do not necessarily represent the official views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. So with that, I would like to be able to hand over our host to our facilitators who will be leading this training today, Larry Cohen and Liz Waiters from the Prevention Institute. So Larry and Liz, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Excellent. Thanks so much, David. Hi, and welcome, everybody. I'm Liz Waiters. I'm a program director here at Prevention Institute in Oakland, California, and I am delighted to be joined by my mentor, executive director, and co-facilitator, Larry Cohen.
Good morning, Liz. Good morning, everyone. Very happy to be here. Let's get started.
All right. Well, as you all know, preventing violence before it occurs requires a systematic and comprehensive approach for changing community conditions and social norms. Now, as part of this comprehensive approach, our current series of web forums have and will continue to focus on building partnerships and collaborations to advance primary prevention of violence against women. These kinds of partnerships can help foster healthy environments and, in turn, healthy behaviors that can prevent violence against women before it occurs in the first place.
Yeah, I think that because the environment has such a powerful influence on our behavior, it's critical to understand and to address, you know, the way our environment shapes norms. When I use the word norms, maybe I'd say they're standards that influence. They also provide a model for behavior. So they're a key mechanism by which institutions, by which organizations translate and affect our behavior through cues in our environment. And I think in our work, Liz, we've really kind of identified there are five norms which come to the top, and probably some of the people watching this have already heard this, but it might be good to review that.
Okay. We're going to start with these five key norms that we've identified. The first is traditional gender roles of men in society, which include those that promote domination, control, and dangerous risk behavior. The second norm is limited gender roles of women in society, including those that promote objectification and oppression of women and girls. The third norm is power, where value is placed on claiming and maintaining control over others. Next, we have violence, which is the norm where aggression is tolerated and blame is attributed to victims. And finally, we have the norm of privacy, where norms associated with individual and family privacy are considered so sacrosanct that secrecy and silence is fostered, and those who witness violence are discouraged from intervening.
So obviously, those norms are hard to change. We can't just change them by telling people. You know, we need to really change institutions. We need to change organizations. That's why I developed the Spectrum Prevention. Until the time of its development, which is, I think, now about 20 years ago, people were mostly thinking when they heard the word prevention about education. And we know telling people is not enough to reduce and eliminate violence against women. We know telling people is not enough to change some of those norms you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. We really need a comprehensive approach. And the Spectrum identifies the six levels, the six elements that together, you know, we can use to devise a comprehensive strategy to change the environments, to change the norms, to ultimately change the behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so today we're going to be focusing on Spectrum Level 4, which is about fostering coalitions and networks. Now, working with coalitions and networks can be especially important in violence against women prevention, because the more partners we bring into the work, the more we challenge the norms that underlie violence against women. Now, obviously, there's a history of successful partnerships and mobilization in the movement, and these partnerships are critical in advancing the work. But at the same time, this level of the spectrum presents a range of challenges, and that's why we've developed a number of tools to help, including those that we've highlighted in our last two web forums, 8 Steps to Coalition Building and Collaboration Math, which, in case any of you have missed those live forums, they're archived on www.preventconnect.org.
Yeah. And, you know, there's another concern that comes up, and it comes up in interdisciplinary collaborations. It comes up in all our coalitions, I think. I think it comes up even when we think about who we're going to partner with and who we're not going to partner with. Mm-hmm. And that question is TERF. And let me just ask everyone who's listening now, when you hear the term TERF, some of your concerns are what brought you to this web forum. So when you hear the word TERF, or when you're thinking about what you want to better understand about TERF, what comes to mind for you? Would you text chat that in, please?
And while you're text chatting in, I'm going to go over the learning objectives for today's forum. We're going to describe TERF, TERFism, and different types of TERF struggles. We're going to present some tools and tips for effectively managing TERF issues. And then we're going to explore TERF issues that emerge in violence against women prevention and brainstorm some strategies to address them.
Money, control and power, territory, difficult collaboration, my territory. Michael Chang saying 25 years of my professional work, stepping on people's toes, old history. The word territory is coming up a lot. Obviously, territory and turf are somehow mine place, you know.
Mm-hmm. Boundaries I saw earlier.
Uh-huh. My job is at stake. Competition for resource, prestige, very, very important parts of it.
Money is a big part of it. These are great. We're going to actually wind up discussing a lot of these particular issues as they are related to violence against women work. So our agenda for today is we're going to start with a brief introduction, then we're going to explore the tension of TERF, including the tips and tools for effective TERF management. And this is going to be followed by a moderated panel with our guest Wendy Loomis from the Pinellas County Health Department in Florida and Dick Bathrick from the Men Stopping Violence Group in Atlanta. And we're going to be weaving in interaction and discussion throughout the forum. And at the end, we're going to have an online evaluation as we normally do. So let's get started.
Well, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, there's this notion of the tension of TERF. But the reason that we wrote the article and are having this forum is because I think a lot of people look at TERF as really a four-letter word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, it's a problem. Or some people have said to me, oh, I never have problems. I'm very pushy. And I insist that people leave their agendas at the door. And I think actually in our work a lot of times we all believe in our agendas, and it's kind of crazy to think about leaving them at the door. So it's better then to really understand and get into the TERF and really try and use it, you know, to really enhance the work that we're doing as opposed to being afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, a lot of what you would talk about. But could people raise your hand if you've experienced issues of TERF in your work preventing violence?
Wow.
Numbers rising quickly.
Just about every hand is raising.
So far we've got a little more than half still rising. And, of course, there's a couple of people who never like to raise their hands. But I would say we've got about two-thirds of the groups saying that they've raised their hands.
Okay, now we want you to do another text chat before we move into this discussion. So for those of you who have experienced issues of TERF, text chat into us how frequently you've experienced issues of TERF in your work, or how frequently these issues come up. Never, once every few months, once a month, once a week, or daily. Once a month, daily, 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 monthly, daily, a lot of dailies, once a month.
Every few months.
Once a year. And I'm guessing that this is probably as often as coalitions meet.
Well, it's probably not just in coalitions, and I think, you know, the coalition, you know, as we've talked about before, Liz, the coalition is kind of you think of as the group sitting around the table, but lots of things go on between meetings. There's lots of things that go on with dyads and triads who might be participating in coalition. Grants come up, and people are kind of maneuvering around
mm-hmm.
who's going to play what role.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think there's a number of different ways that we see this arising, and I really want to thank everyone for their honest responses.
Yes, thank you. So what exactly do we mean by TERF? Well, historically, the term TERF refers to how property is divided up. And in the case of coalitions, this would refer to things like who gets the recognition and the financial or political resources. The definition that we like to use is from Peck and Haig, who describe TERF as the non-cooperation or conflict between individuals or organizations that have seemingly common goals. Now, TERF struggles affect every single member of the coalition as well as the coalition itself. So keeping this definition in mind, we'd like you to take a moment to text chat to us about the kinds of TERF conflicts you've experienced. And they may be the same that you've been talking about already over money, boundaries, but here you go, coverage of services, concealing information, money, fundraising, legal issues.
Oh, military versus civilian, that's
awesome.
Good.
Yes, best practices.
Philosophy,
Mm-hmm. Overlapping of services.
Not honoring each other's work.
Mm-hmm.
Our way or no way.
Confidentiality.
Ownership.
I see boundaries coming up a lot.
Yeah.
Excellent.
You know, what's interesting about what I'm seeing as we're watching this, it seems like you can break these into two different types in a way. Some are honest and practical differences that groups may have, and you might call that boundary
mm-hmm.
issues. And some seem to be more of this almost like a moral term that comes in here. And I think that's something we may want to just talk about a little bit further today. You know, my way or no way, you know, that's almost like, wait a minute, you know, there's, you can see the backs rising as we think about that, or, you know, unfair manipulation, you know, philosophical differences could be realistic, or philosophical definition is, wait a minute, is it philosophical? Concealing information sounds like there's kind of a moral characteristic to
mm-hmm.
it. Sometimes people take things that may be more practical, realistic differences and over moralize them, and that's going to make the turf a little bit more difficult
mm-hmm.
to come across.
Well, what we're seeing here are a variety of different types of turf issues that have been coming up. Now, while we often view turf through the lens of a battle metaphor, where, for example, two sides vie for control and ownership, and only one side can be victorious, in the coalition context, turf becomes far more complex than just two sides fighting for their own personal gain. So instead, we have coalition members who are required to balance their personal agendas and their organization's sense of mission or financial welfare with the coalition's shared goals. And in fact, it's this need to wear many hats that can lead to turf conflict within coalitions.
Yeah, and I don't think turf conflict, as I'm saying, is always a bad sign. In fact, you know, turf is natural, but it really depends on how we handle it, how we react to it, how we try and steer away from the moral issues, the other person is bad, the other person is wrong, the other person is over-controlling, though we all come in with our characters and our personal styles, which certainly are going to be part of all this and really, in a way, complicating it. But I think part of it is accepting that these differences are really part of, you know, demonstrating the locus of issues that a coalition is dealing with.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think the best coalitions are made up of?
Well, you know, it's going to be people who are really passionate about what they believe in. It's going to be people who really are there because they want to move an agenda forward. And they've come there, I think, with a vision of what the directions in which they want to go, why they care. And obviously, no two people, no two institutions or organizations are going to come with the exact same vision. And I think sometimes that's where some of this turf comes from, which in a way we can describe as, you know, potentially productive explosion,
mm-hmm.
though often it turns out, unless it's well understood, well handled, and not feared, it's not going to be as productive.
Okay. Well, keeping that in mind, thanks, Larry. I'd like to have you all take a moment to text chat to us about why you think people join coalitions in the first place. Because in order to understand why turf struggles arise, it's important to understand why members join coalitions, what their motivations are for joining coalitions, and how their own goals might interplay with those of the coalition.
Exactly, exactly.
Finding allies, not duplicating things, pooling resources, strength in numbers, building strength, shared goals, financial resources. Mm-hmm.
Greater access to resources.
Furthering the agenda for everyone, broadening services, sharing resources comes up a lot, networking, mm-hmm. keeping current, exactly.
Collaboration appeals to funders, and that obviously means that money's in the middle of that one, Dorothy, and that's probably going to mean there's also some conflict at times. Providing a holistic, comprehensive approach to victims, that's excellent. Getting a fresh outlook. Reducing isolation, and I think when people come from that perspective, you know, the turf may not arise as much because they're really feeling the sense of support, and I think that's something we can build in
mm-hmm.
when we talk a little later about here's some things to help with turf.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're all bringing up excellent points, and obviously there are many reasons for joining a coalition. not all of which are going to be completely explicit. Larry, why don't you tell us some of the other reasons that people would join?
Well, you know, as we said, it's, you know, when people are passionate or, you know, being up to date. These are actually aren't other reasons. Most people have said this. Sometimes, you know, they've got friends or colleagues, you know, who kind of see an issue as important and say, well, let's kind of be engaged in this together. Together we can accomplish more than any of us can alone. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we really want to feel like we're part of a movement and our work might be more service-oriented or more narrow, and we feel like, you know, we're not quite able to accomplish it, you know, just by ourselves. The funder demand one was also mentioned, and I think that's going to also, you know, if you're there because of funding, there's also the potential of strife because of funding.
Mm-hmm.
And then also this notion of social support. It's pretty rare that you have a coalition where people are joining just for one of those reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to be a mix, and particularly people often go because they're invited, and they may not even be that explicit about what they're hoping to get out of it. And that might be one thing to think about, is trying to get people explicit, either in one-on-one conversations, you know, here's what, how you could benefit, what do you see as the benefits, so that people come in with a sense of what the purposes and the outcomes might be.
Mm-hmm. And some probably lesser-known reasons that people might join a coalition, well, according to protection theory, for example, a coalition might form because the group experiences or perceives a threat to its sovereignty. For example, the group might fear that the coalition could reframe a public debate around a key issue, which would consequently undermine the group's own viewpoint or its credibility and importance. Or else the coalition might win funding that could have otherwise gone to an individual group. So now, obviously, when groups join coalitions primarily to protect their own turf, the risk of a struggle is going to be heightened.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, one of the first major coalitions I was involved in was the first multi-city coalition on tobacco control in the country. And there were three kind of major partners along with public health, which were the Cancer Society, Heart Association, and Lung Association. I won't say which of the three, but two of the three were quite willing, and the third was like, well, we really don't want to do this. We'd rather stay with services and with fundraising, but we don't want to be left out. We're afraid there's going to be a lot of attention and we're not going to get any of it. And that led to a certain amount of tension because they were always kind of dragging us down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it was really valuable to have all those three groups working together. But there was this TERF thing because their interests were, you know, slightly different. And part of the solution was kind of saying, hey, wait a minute, we're going to expand the pie for everyone. You know, but it was important to be aware of what the specific agendas were and how much of it related to funding.
Okay. Well, taking that in mind, I'd like you all to take us another minute to text chat to us why you think TERF conflicts arise in the first place and the work that you've done and the conflicts that you've experienced. What was underlying these particular conflicts?
Limited resources,
mm-hmm.
recognition. I think we'll see some of the terms we've seen before. Stress, fear.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Lack of trust. Power struggles.
Ego.
Mm-hmm. Different goals. Statistics.
History. That's a very important one. Discontent staff.
Undefined goals. Power struggles, competition. Mm-hmm.
Fear of losing power or funding, Nancy. Mm-hmm. Insecurity.
Funding and who's the expert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, I'm seeing this in the article that I had put together on TERF. I don't think I was as conscious of it as what I'm really seeing from the text chat, is this bifurcation of some of these are kind of the character issues,
mm-hmm.
and some of these are more the practical issues. And again, I think if we can try and as they say in conflict resolution, separate the people from the problem and not kind of focus on you're a bad person, Liz, because you want to do things a little differently than me,
mm-hmm.
but more you have one direction and I may have a slightly different direction, and how do we create a win-win situation?
Mm-hmm.
That's going to enable probably more success. A lot of what's up there, and it is real and it is part of it, is this issue about, you know, the ego or the stress or the tension or the, you know, the over-competition at times.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, you know, particularly when we talk about violence against women prevention, you know, we're talking about crumbs. And when there are crumbs, people fight over crumbs. And when there's enough to go around, you know, it's a lot better. So we have to work really hard on this and really remember. And, you know, who's going to benefit ultimately, why we're really doing this work, even though there are crumbs, because we can be in fields where there's a lot more resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, this goes back, Larry, to what you were saying earlier, that turf struggles come up because members are dedicated to their work. So what we're talking about is that passion that people bring to the, coalition. And how important it is to honor that passion, because it's the lifeblood of the coalition. So the challenge for coalition leadership then is going to be to figure out how to acknowledge, accept, and build upon these turf issues.
That's right. And, you know, the most common turf struggle, I think we saw it here, is financial resources. You know, but again, there's the recognition, there's the publicity, there's the control of the coalition identity.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the underlying, as we were just talking about that, you know, there's issues of ego, there's who's more outspoken, there's who's more pushy. You know, the way people's individual characteristics, you know, may play out in kind of, perhaps we might almost call them coalition personality conflicts, you know, will drive this. But what's at stake then? You know, it's the recognition, it's the money, it's the control, it's the publicity, it's the direction. And, you know, I think that's the place we probably want to do most of our work.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned ego earlier, and one of the things that we need to acknowledge is that tension within a coalition might not always be generated by turf. Sometimes non-coalition-related issues are brought into the coalition. So, for example, there might be a history of bad relations between two of the groups.
That's right. Somebody chatted that in and identified that.
And these kinds of struggles might be an issue of character or personality, but sometimes people are just argumentative, in which case turf isn't the issue, and strategies for resolving turf won't always apply.
But strong facilitation will apply. And we really need to kind of handle those issues and not let them get out of control. And when I say we, I just want to be clear, as we've been in our past coalition discussions, is that we all have to share in the leadership. There may be a facilitator, there may be a chair of a meeting, and certainly there are times that those people should be deferred to, but there's also times that we all need to step in and say, hey, wait a minute, this is not okay. And I know in some coalitions I've chaired, I've really felt like there were things I could or couldn't say, and I felt really supported when other people stepped in and kind of said, hey, wait a minute, this is getting too far afield, the coalition's work. And I think sometimes members have said, you know, the chair really needs to be more forceful and not allow this, you know, this ego or this out of, you know, non-topical concern to get, you know, to get in the way. I mean, I was in one coalition where it turned out I was representing county government. It turned out there was a bad history between the community groups and county government from 15, 20 years before I'd even been there, but they were going to play it out in this meeting, and they just were not going to get along. And that's not that uncommon, I'm afraid.
Well, I mean, along those lines, there are also three different types of turf struggle. Most people assume that turf is between two coalition members. But there's actually one type of turf issues between coalition members and other coalition members. So, for example, the battle for resources, which we've seen mentioned a number of times, the battle for recognition, these often have historical roots, as you've mentioned. There's also the, for example, imagine a violence prevention coalition that includes two members who are executive directors from service-providing organizations. These people could have a history of tension, just as you just described, that could easily carry over into the coalition proceedings.
Right, or there just may not be really enough money for it to go around for both. I mean, one may say, wait a minute, there's a grant coming up right now, and I need to secure my staff, and that becomes a natural and all-encompassing goal and can really get in the way of perhaps what's best from the perspective of the coalition, or more importantly, what's best from the perspective of the community. Another thing that arises, though, and most people when they think about TERF are thinking that two members are fighting and the chair is kind of the neutral party, but actually the coalition itself can end up in a TERF struggle with a member, where we form this umbrella organization and it says, okay, well now we should apply for the grants, or we should be the go-to place when people are, when the press is asking for information. And all of a sudden, several of the members may be saying, hey, wait a minute, we formed this to work together for mutual benefit, and now the coalition is competing with us. And why did I join this coalition, and how can I be a part of something which is in effect taking away my resource or my recognition or my objective or my decision-making, and that comes up a lot. And it can also come up, I think, Liz, with the lead agency in a coalition, right?
Exactly. And in that sense, that, I mean, very similar, the lead agency might be eligible for resources that the individual members would normally have been eligible for, but because they're part of, they're representing the larger coalition, they have a stronger case to make. And so that could breed resentment really quickly as well.
So let's think now about how the TERF plays out, because TERF struggles can be overt
mm-hmm.
or they can be covert.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're covert, it's much more difficult to resolve. At least if we know what's going on, if we can get it open, you know, it's a little bit more straightforward. But with covert battles, I think we've got to bring them out into the open.
Mm-hmm. And as we've already mentioned, you know, evenly, seemingly overt TERF struggles could have hidden elements. You know, we've referred a lot to the historical conflicts between members, or, you know, things that came up like the philosophical differences, you know, the difference over values in the group. So,
and let's be frank about it, that in an issue like this, those values are going to be very, very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And there are values around gender. There are values around oppression. There are values around, you know, how politically radical to be, how much to kind of play the games of government or funders versus how much to stand up. And people often feel slighted by people who have a different perspective on those issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, TERF is a hard issue for coalitions to resolve precisely because organizations are forced to balance important external commitments against their own sense of mission or financial welfare. So because a little bit of preliminary guidance can go a long way, Prevention Institute developed the following suggestions to help manage TERF effectively. And as we go through each of these next 10 tips for effective TERF management, we encourage you all out there to text chat in about any similar techniques you've used to resolve your own TERF struggles. So let's go ahead and start with our first tip.
Let's just see if there's any responses first in terms of techniques you have for handling TERF.
Communication, mutual respect, listen more, take a great facilitator, create and focus on mutual goals and objectives, inclusion, pointing out one another's strengths. I like that.
Focus on the clients, active listening, clear goals, clear rules.
Meeting halfway, focus on the mission continually.
Open-mindedness, collaborating on grant applications,
mm-hmm.
that's at times, I'm just laughing at the next one, at times difficult, I was going to say, deep breathing and reduced defensiveness, yeah? Deep breathing may be an important cue here. Core values and principles. Well, let's go now to the tips just for the sake of time, and I think people will keep chatting in. The first one, I think, is just to be straightforward about it. Having honest conversations with participants and talking with people one-on-one at times about the history of relationships, you know, between different members.
Mm-hmm.
And also the history of relationships between the organizations and the members, which at times is different. Two people may not have a history, but their organizations do, and they may kind of pick that up. You know, I mean, I know there's some organizations we work with a great deal of trust and respect, and others we're a little wary of. And, you know, I would probably describe it as an executive director. I'm worried that they're going to, you know, step onto some of our turf, that they're going to take some of our areas of authority or our areas of influence or our areas of resource. And, you know, I don't always say it that frankly, but I bet it spreads out to the staff subtly. So, you know, a key thing to try is to choose coalition members who really have a general sense and are open to really you know, not be so influenced by the past.
Mm-hmm.
It may be their job description. Executive director is going to be more money-oriented. An educational director who works with youth all the time might be a better representative in a case like
mm-hmm.
that, because they're less concerned about the history and more concerned about the outcome.
Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense. And personalities can make some people less influenced by the past. And I like the way you described that in terms of this inherited history sometimes. Our second tip is to talk details. It's about encouraging members to openly discuss their reasons for being at the table and sharing information about their respective organizations. Here we suggest developing a collaborative document that includes the goals, roles, and investment of each partner, and that includes a budget and a timeline.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. So that means, you know, at initial coalition meetings, really allowing time for, you know, purposes. and really getting on the table, not just the coalition purpose, but in effect why different people are there. What's the core mission of each organization? What are some of its key funding sources? What activities might threaten the funding base?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, using the word threaten, you know, it sometimes doesn't come up in coalitions, and it's very important to acknowledge we are going to be threatened, and let's find out what the threats are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would enhance the funding base? What would be valuable to people? You know, how can we use the coalition to ensure it adds value? Who are the key constituencies of different groups? And, you know, what are the strategies members use? Because, you know, there can be conflict. Why can't we just educate? We don't want to do policy. Oh, we want to work within the schools on organizational change. And sometimes if we can lay all those out and see it clearly, and the collaboration math tool we talked about in our last web forum is a really good tool for laying this out by organization, because it's really a grid and a matrix.
Mm-hmm.
But really being clear and doing that early on in a coalition, I think, can be very, very beneficial. Because then people are, you know, moving from a sense that the coalition is not just the group, but it's also there to benefit the individual groups, which are also doing very important work.
Mm-hmm. And this goes back to several of the comments where people mentioned that communication is key, open,
yeah.
honest communication.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to our third tip then, which is about shaping collective identity. For our third tip, while members should be encouraged to express individual needs and limits, shaping a common focus and a collective identity is going to be essential.
Yeah, I think that you know, as I said earlier, this notion of, okay, leave your hat at the door is unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, we don't just want people there, you know, with their individual organizations. We really want them to take pride in the work that they're doing together. And this notion of collective identity, that we have accomplished something, perhaps we have accomplished something that's greater than any of us could have done individually, and really being proud of that and saying, hey, this is another part of my work that I feel really good about. This is another way I'm having an effect that I'm really, really proud of.
Mm-hmm. And this goes back to what you said earlier about sharing the limelight, you know, rotating meetings amongst member organizations,
yeah.
making sure that different groups and subgroups get to take the lead in public presentations about the coalition's activities. All of these things play into helping shape that collective group identity.
That's right. Each member should feel important,
mm-hmm.
but they should also feel their role as part of a more complete picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to our next tip.
Well, let's look at, for a minute at this
Plain
Dealer article because, you know, as we were saying, it's important that all coalition members, you know, kind of feel comfortable, maybe even empowered, to represent the coalition. And one way of sharing the limelight is, of course, the media. In fact, it's one of the more important ways, I think, in terms of turf struggles. So we're working here at Prevention Institute on the Unity Project, Liz, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a national initiative designed to support cities, particularly the 45 largest cities in the United States, to prevent violence before it occurs, particularly the violence that affects youth the most. And an essential part of building the national momentum is empowering the cities themselves to promulgate that violence prevention message. So, you know, in Cleveland, you know, working with the coalition, they did this article featuring our Unity co-chair, Dr. Deborah Prothero-Stith, and Natoya Walker, who's the steering committee member, the city council member, working with the mayor, and the mayor and the city council. And so it was kind of using some of the coalition capacity to really highlight an individual member's leadership in a way that would be most beneficial in their own town.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps if Deborah, as the Unity co-chair, was not there, we couldn't have gotten the article in. But on the other hand, getting the article in and not talking about Natoya Walker, you know, again, it would not have shared the limelight in the way that can be really, really effective.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very specific example.
No, that's a great example of the interrelationship between individual members and the larger coalition. Thanks, Larry.
Yep.
Okay, so for our fourth tip, it's about fair decision-making.
Yeah, it's critical that decision-making processes be consistently applied and based on minority support.
Mm-hmm. So,
I'm sorry, based on majority support. Good thing Nicole was here to correct me on that.
Well, one of the things that would be helpful in applying this tip is consider defining consensus not as 100% agreement, but rather as what the majority supports and what everyone can live with.
That's right, because otherwise decision-making itself becomes so cumbersome. that it's almost like an outgrowth of TERF that makes it kind of unbreathable, unworkable in the coalition. But this definition, I find, works very well. In fact, in a lot of cases, decisions just kind of happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there shouldn't be a lot of votes. You know, it's almost like, you know, ideally we just kind of reach agreement and it feels natural and we just kind of move forward.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is a conflict, this definition of consensus making early on, I think, is much more helpful, or you can spend a lot of time stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. For our fifth tip?
It's seeking funding for coalition coordination,
mm-hmm.
because it really takes work to get the coalition working. We really need to ensure that there is the kind of leadership, that there's time not only for the conversations within the coalition, but a lot of the one-on-one conversations which really build the understanding and can be problem-solving, you know, as different kinds of issues may arise.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if there's some funding for the coalition and that's clear and it's established and it's kind of at an acceptable level, we can get rid of that competition that often arises, as we were saying, between the coalition and the members.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really focus on the member partnership as opposed to the coalition saying, oh, no, now we really need to kind of move forward.
That makes perfect sense, because ideology and funding are so intricately tied to each other that it's important to consider a plan for how resource needs are going to be shared and how to acquire and distribute new resources. And I saw that earlier in one of someone's text chat comment about applying for grant applications together. So to do this, one of the things that we suggest is that the coalition explore a continuum of support that would allow members to participate at different levels, from financial support to staff time to providing insight and research.
Yeah.
Now, we want you to remember, as we are going through these tips, please feel free to keep text chatting your experiences with similar TERF management techniques, what has or hasn't worked, what you would do differently next time.
Good. So tip six, and we're going through a lot of this because I think these specific items are really the things that can be the difference between, you know, success or failure. You know, tip six is to reward members and celebrate successes. And I know it's something that I don't always do well enough. I feel like sometimes, okay, we've succeeded at this, now we're way behind on the next thing, and we just kind of move. We got to stop and give ourselves credit. And we really, in a coalition, need to make sure that we're giving the members credit, but also in terms of what we said, one of the earlier tips about the organizational identity, celebrating success, I think, is a really important part of it, because it's important that coalition benefits exceed the costs. You know, if you bring people together, give them something in return so they feel like it's worthwhile for them. And I think we got to take time to acknowledge success
mm-hmm.
along the way. So there we were.
And this is us at Prevention Institute.
Old office, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, we here like to celebrate our successes around food, healthy food, of course.
Yeah, we try healthy.
Okay, for tip number seven, this is about building bridges, which is about maintaining a friendly, respectful tone. Coalition members are just people, and when they like each other, the work is going to tend to flow more smoothly. So here it's important to take time after meetings to socialize and allow coalition members to just enjoy one another.
Yeah, and speaking of that food thing, I think that actually refreshments are an important part of meeting because they encourage people to linger.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even refreshments at the beginning. You know, people don't always, hopefully meetings start on time, but sometimes they start a few minutes late as people gather, chances to chit-chat. I think people often make the mistake, and it's very important with TERF, really, that the coalition is the group, whereas the coalition is also the dyads, the triads, and that's where some of the conflict is often arising.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of creating this environment. And then by providing refreshments, by allowing the time for the conversation, by showing the sense of caring, the sense of appreciation, you're also downplaying some of the potential conflict between the coalition and the members, because you're saying, wait a minute, the coalition recognizes member contribution. It's token, but it's a very important token, I think, the refreshment, the opportunity, the chit-chat, all that kind
mm-hmm.
of stuff.
Yeah, just one more opportunity to bring people together to focus on their commonalities, and who doesn't like good refreshment?
Yeah. I think the eighth tip, Liz, is a really important one, reminding participants of the big picture.
Mm-hmm. And this happens to relate to basically
making sure that people understand why they're there in the first place, why they're a part of a larger coalition in the first place. So sometimes there are many people in a coalition who aren't interested in fighting for turf, and these are the people in the coalition who often are best suited to resolve any kind of turf issues between fellow coalition
participants. That's right.
So, for example, survivors,
yeah.
community members,
yes.
and individuals from the faith community are going to tend to have higher credibility because of their perceived neutrality coupled with their dedication to the cause and the fact that they usually don't have side agendas. So just as we can see where bystanders can help prevent domestic violence
uh-huh.
and bullying,
uh-huh.
certain coalition members are going to be able to help reconnect disputing members to the coalition's bigger picture and remind members why they joined the coalition in the first place.
That's right. There was a violence coalition I was part of, where several of the members were fighting over who would be the lead in a new grant. And we had some young people, in fact, a young person who had done this, this was actually part of a quilt,
mm-hmm.
and then it was made into a poster, tragically in honor of a family member of his. He stood up and said, wait a minute, are you forgetting why we're here? And so here you had this 15-year-old, tears in his eyes, saying, you know, we're talking about my friends, my cousins, my brother and sister, and you're fighting over the money or the recognition. That's not what this is about. Needless to say, everyone was awed, everyone was humbled, and everyone was reminded. And there are times as a facilitator that I'll say to people before the meeting, there's one minister, for example, who I think has been very, very constructive because he's not involved in the turf. You might joke and say he sees a higher value and has a higher credibility. And I say, I want you to be aware, I think this problem may arise in the meeting because we should be able to at times to predict the turf problems that are going to come up in meetings. I want you to be aware that this problem may arise, and I want you to step in from the perspective of your standing in the community because you're a neutral voice. I'm the facilitator, but it can't just come from one voice. And I think that tip that you're suggesting of reminding participants of the big picture is a very, very important one, Liz.
Mm-hmm. And thanks for sharing that, because young people are often seen as neutral members, and people will often listen to what they have to say.
That's right.
That's very
important. And there's often talk, we need to include young people, and then sometimes there's this split, well, what are professionals and young people? How do they work together in a coalition?
Mm-hmm.
And here's an example of an incredible added value of people who not only know the situation, but really have their heart in the situation.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think we all do. But I think as professionals, sometimes we get a little bit lost. We forget kind of the initial motivation as we get caught up in the nitty-gritty of survival of our work, you know.
Mm-hmm. So as we move on, we are at slide 46 now. This is tip 9, make turf struggles overt. So as we've been saying all along, turf struggles can only be addressed if members admit that they're there in the first place. The coalition's lead agency should be especially alert to turf struggles and admit the problem. The chair or neutral member could even meet with members individually if she or he feels that turf issues are coming up and aren't being handled well.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking about this issue, and let me just raise it with people. How would you make turf struggles overt? You know, what would you do or what have you done to kind of bring turf issues out into the open? Could you text chat that in, those of you who've kind of dealt with this? Well, what did you fail to do, perhaps?
That's a great question, too, yeah. Conversations.
Make the observations, being honest.
Mm-hmm. Talking about it. Talk about the pink elephant in the room, exactly. So here, communication does seem to be the key. Yep.
Good timing.
Try to foster accountability, setting example. Excellent. Encourage free speech and sharing ideals.
What if you're not the ED and don't have the power to address it? We'll come back to that in a minute.
Hold people accountable. Encourage members to share rather than only telling certain people. Oh, someone here, Nancy Taylor, developed partnership agreements that really made differences explicit.
Mm-hmm, and that can come nicely out of the collaboration math charting, I think. Yeah.
Remind people of their common ground, why they're there in the first place. These are great. Well, as we move on to our 10th and final tip, we're here at number slide 48. This tip is about acknowledging that the more rigid people are, the harder coalition cooperation is going to be. So here you need to create an open environment where members feel comfortable with diverse perspectives and with conflict. Now this is going to be critical. To this extent, humor is always helpful, and as are ground rules that are going to ask people to describe disagreements without personal criticism.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we were commenting earlier, Liz, when there was early on comments about what the problems were, words like ego came up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Words, nobody said, oh, other people have a horrible personality, but I know we all feel it at times in some of these situations. And I think the ground rules becomes really important then.
Mm-hmm.
Because without the ground rules, and I don't want to get into this, you know, that we have to put a big list of ground rules on the wall at every meeting, though there are certain situations where you really do have to do that. But really, it's kind of more a norm. We talk about norms. An organizational norm that we're really not going to have personal criticism, you know, that we're going to try and get to the root of problems, that I think just accepting the turf, as all these tips do and as the whole conversation does, goes a long way. That says from the beginning of the coalition, we understand that. I just wanted to comment before we moved on. There were a couple of important questions that came up earlier about boundaries, whether certain things worked. And we're going to have a Q&A after we have the our two guests. Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage people to raise their hand and ask those questions, and we'll all talk about them. Verbally a little bit later, because I know we need to move on right now.
Thanks, Larry. Okay, well, now that we've gone through all 10 tips for effectively managing turf, we want to see how some of them have been applied to real-life turf conflicts within the Violence Against Women movement. We're delighted to be joined today by Wendy Loomis in Florida and Dick Bathrick in Georgia. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Hi, Dick. He's out there, too. Well, I'm going to facilitate a brief discussion with our guests to further highlight some of the roots of turf struggle and hopefully provide some insights to make the process of addressing turf in your own work more manageable. And I want to start by introducing Wendy and Dick. First up, we have Wendy Loomis, who is a program manager for the Injury and Violence Prevention Program at the Pinellas County Health Department in St. Petersburg, Florida. She's the chair of the Countywide Domestic Violence Task Force and serves on several coalitions that address family violence. Thanks for being with us here today, Wendy.
Thank you for having me, Liz.
Wonderful to have you here with us, Wendy.
Thanks, Wendy.
And Dick Bathrick is co-founder of Men Stopping Violence in Atlanta, Georgia. He's currently the director of programs and oversees all program initiatives, including community education, public policy, and interventions with men. Thank you for being here with us as well, Dick.
Great to be here.
Can you hear me?
Tried to get back in.
Oh, good. Glad that happened. We know that Men Stopping Violence in Atlanta is really very thoughtful and strategic, both in what they do internally in terms of your own organization and how that gets expressed externally. So we're thrilled to have you joining us today.
Mm-hmm. Well, Wendy, I'm going to start with you. Now, I understand that you worked on a two-year effort to bring together intimate partner violence and child abuse prevention groups. While our audience is looking at their mission statements of the health department and the task force, could you talk a little bit about why you thought it was important to bring together the IPV and child abuse prevention groups?
Well, Liz, as many people on the call probably know, there's a long history of, I guess you could say, conflict between those two groups. Because of their different perspectives on how to protect children and how to protect and the victims of and survivors of domestic violence. And in our community, in our state, our child protection system is privatized, and so our state agency a couple of years ago required the private agencies to have an agreement with the local domestic violence centers to try to improve those relationships. And they provided a template for everybody to sign, and our community decided instead of signing the template that we would create our own. And so we met for 2 years, and I was one of the facilitators, because I'm not in either of those agencies, to bring those folks together and really work out a more effective agreement that was, I guess, more real, because we worked on it together and we didn't just sign the, you know, the given one.
Well, Wendy, what were the primary challenges in bringing these groups together?
One of the challenges, I would say, would be getting the right people there, because this was an agreement that had to be signed. We had to have the executive directors of the agencies, and some who had a long history of really not working together, not trusting one another. So that was the first thing, to get them all there. And then to sort of, once we got there and we got through the agreement, to really be able to then translate the agreement to the staff, the actual people who had to implement the agreement. Also some of whom had bad history and some had good history. So we had to really think through how we were going to, you know, put it out to several hundred people to be able to then do the agreement that we agreed on.
Okay. Well, this is really interesting. So in terms of getting the right people to the table, what did you do to do that? What did you and your co-chair do either behind the scenes or in the context of meetings to bring these two sides together?
It was a lot of phone calls, private phone calls, really, between, you know, me calling or the other facilitator calling people. We also had, coincidentally, a great catalyst of a new project that had almost forced some of those players to start talking to be able to apply for a grant, a federal grant called Safe Start, where we were looking at working with children exposed to violence. And so that brought in the child abuse and the domestic violence piece. And so some of us had already started talking to be able to apply for that grant. And then when this agreement, or, you know, the template of the agreement came from the state, we thought we should use these relationships that we had started to build to try to make that relationship, to make that agreement better. So it really had to do, and I think, too, it had to do, you've talked some in the conference call about facilitators and strong facilitation, and I think that was important, too. The Safe Start director, you know, who was directing the grant, as well, and me were the two facilitators, and we didn't work for any of the agencies that were involved, and we were seen as neutral.
So
we were more trusted, I think.
It's interesting, Wendy, that you're describing kind of the grant as a kind of a catalyst, because I think that it, you know, one of the turf tips perhaps for funders is if they want to encourage people to work together, that the way they design funding, the questions they ask, you know, who needs to be at the table can really be a big catalyst for that. I know a lot of funders, you know, have really been encouraging collaboration, but I'm not sure they've thought about TERF in a very thoughtful way. It might be an important message for us to bring to the funding community, too.
Well, Wendy, let me ask you this also. How did you, what did it take to translate the agreement to the people who were going to be implementing the plan?
Well, it was a series of training and, you know, dissemination essentially of the agreement itself. And I would say, you know, looking back a couple years later, that it probably didn't make it all the way to everyone it needed to make it to, unfortunately. But I think, you know, a lot of it had to do with how does child protection contact someone who's in a shelter. And so the shelter folks basically carry that agreement with them when somebody knocks on their door. And so we've done a lot of work, and some successfully and some less so maybe, about making sure that everybody who works in those agencies that would be affected by that have a copy of that agreement. So
And one more question around how you got this to work. In terms of the history of bad relations, how did you deal with that?
I think the first meeting we started to deal with it by my co-facilitator and I had everybody write down something about each person in the room that was positive. So they had to really, and we passed the paper around with everybody's name on the top. And so then at the end, the facilitators read off what people said about each individual, and it was all upbeat. And so we started with that to, you know, some respect, which I've seen people text in about, and realizing that everybody was there for the same purpose. And that, you know, we really wanted to help families, you know, be safe. So we started with that. And then I think really it had to do with just sitting at that table over and over. We met monthly for a very long time. It took us about 14 months to get it all, you know, what we wanted it to be. And that really changed the relationship, just doing that. And I think the strong facilitation of being able, you know, knowing who was probably going to try and stop it, and, and being able to stop them, have that, you know, those people's respect enough that when we said, you know, we need to move on from that, that they would be quiet and let us move on. So, you know, it had to do with a lot of the personalities. And I can say now that a lot of those people will pick up the phone to call each other, which they never would have done before that.
Just curious, Wendy, when you said it took 14 months, and it
yes.
sounds like it was well worth doing, if there hadn't been the turf history, how long do you think it would have taken for the same work to go on?
There hadn't been the, should have been much quicker. We probably would have just
uh-huh.
signed the agreement that the state sent us.
uh-huh.
So, but I think actually there was a willingness at that point to really delve a little deeper.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, our private agency has changed, unfortunately, twice since then. And so each time we've had to sort of, and we're about to redo it again, which in a way is good because we really have found that we need to revisit it because it's not, it, you know, people forget.
Mm-hmm. Well, Wendy, what were the outcomes of this collaboration?
Well, the working agreement still is in effect, and the new relationships that were formed at that time are still, as far as I can see, working well. And in fact, they've increased because some of the players have changed, and each time a player changes, I notice that people will go connect with that person. So it's really, you know, there's a commitment to keep that going. We also, I'm now also the chair of the Domestic Violence Task Force and have done a lot of work in getting child protection people to come to those meetings, which they never had done before as well. So, you know, sort of continuing that neutral stand. And then the other thing is that we are now all working together on an event for Domestic Violence Month in October where we're going to do an all-day training where we're going to teach each other about what each agency does and our perspectives and sort of some next steps at the end to look at some best practices around the country of how we can improve our response to children and families who are experiencing violence. So it's still going.
Excellent. Well, let me ask you one last question, Wendy.
Yes.
If you could do it all over again, what, if anything, would you do differently and why?
I think one thing we should have done a better job with was the training of staff. I don't think we followed up as much as we could have, some of the agencies that were part of it. I think we should have used a prevention focus more because I think we would find more common ground in the prevention area than what we were dealing with was mostly intervention. And so I think, you know, we need to talk more about that together. And we're working on that now as we prepare for our October event. And I think, too, that we should have been a little more prepared for the outcome of particularly talking about our Safe Start grant, where we started really educating the community about how much it being exposed to violence hurts kids. And we weren't really prepared for how that was going to play out in the community, which was child protection thinking there was another thing they had to protect children from.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, so we didn't really think ahead on that one very well. So we're,
I think you're making some really interesting points. One is that, you know, we're talking about TERF as though it's existing in a vacuum, but
mm-hmm.
the TERF really interplays with the content that you're working on. And
mm-hmm.
I think, as you're saying, if you can broaden the content to primary prevention, primary prevention has a broadness of goal, which
mm-hmm.
often will kind of help with the TERF at least because people can see, as we see in this Venn diagram here, people can see how their work is complementary but contributing to the broader goal.
Mm-hmm.
I really like, you know, I had mentioned as one of the TERF tips, or perhaps Liz, you mentioned it, the kind of making the issues explicit at
mm-hmm.
the beginning. But I really love the way you did it, Wendy. You made the TERF explicit in a very, very positive way by saying, hey, there may be issues here. Let's start out by saying what we really like and respect about one another, as opposed to, you know, kind of laying out the problems and making it painful and acting like TERF is a four-letter word.
Mm-hmm.
You were anticipating, acknowledging, and really, really doing it. The other thing I'd like to say is, you know, kind of, as I know we need to move on, Liz, but it really is preventative, it sounds like, because as you said, well, gee, it could have gone a lot quicker, and it will next time.
Uh-huh.
And as new
right.
members come in, it sounds like you've really changed the norms of the organization so that they're now much more comfortable and happy
yeah.
in a mutual participation.
And they're much more willing to talk to one another.
Good
now.
For you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, Wendy.
Thank
well,
you.
Now, Dick, I'd like to ask you, Men Stopping Violence is a men's group that's working in a field that's deeply rooted in the women's movement, which means that in many ways your organization is working on women's turf. What issues have come up for you in relation to the work that you do?
Well, you know, our mission is to end men's violence against women, and our take is that men will stop doing that when we decide to do it, and that'll happen when the communities in which we reside say that it's unacceptable and ultimately impose meaningful consequences. To do that, we need to work in solidarity with women, because how would we know if our strategies are working if we don't build in women's voices and experiences?
Mm-hmm.
So that's easily said, but how does that really happen in a way that it works for women and for men to have those kinds of communication exchanges? Structurally, this is our 26th year, and since our beginning, that 26 years, all but two of those years, two of our presidents have been women, and of 20 of those years, our executive director has been a woman, and the predominance of the board members is women. So there's a kind of accountability that we try to build in structurally within our organization. What were you going to say?
Excellent. Did you have a question?
No, I just said that was very interesting. Sorry, Dick.
Okay. We also pursue, we try to make our work transparent by going to our state coalition, to state commission, to women-centered organizations, to invite them to witness the work and give us feedback on whether or not ultimately they see it working for women or not for women.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to model a kind of structural accountability where we're not just waiting to find out. We're inviting that kind of information. And I think there's a lot of suspicion with good reason, you know. We're working with batterers, you know. How come, you know, are we colluding? Are we talking about the Braves in there? What are we doing when we engage with men? And
mm-hmm.
I think that we have to build in ways that people can really witness and comment in our work.
Well, Dick, you just mentioned suspicion. What are some of the other major challenges that you've faced as a result of turf issues?
Well, I think that one of the things that happens is that when we really operate under one of our core principles, which is that women's voices and experience are central to our work, then men have to figure out, so does this mean that we're just sort of like kowtowing to women, that we really hate men and we only really respect women? So how do we practice our principles in such a way that we engage with men and connect with men but not collude with men?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of our challenges. Because, as I say, we make it pretty clear to the men that whether it's mainstream men that we're working with or recruiting, or whether it's men in our classes, that the reason for our existence is to make communities safer for women, and we think it's in men's interest to do that.
Yeah, that actually speaks to tip number three, shaping collective identity, drawing people to the larger reason. Dick, in terms of a lot of the challenges that you face, and you've mentioned a couple of ideas here, what are some specific things that Men Stopping Violence has done to overcome the challenges of turf issues?
Well, some of the core principles that we operate on, one is the Women's Experience Central. Another one is race matters.
Mm-hmm.
In our movement, Battered Women's Movement, the Violence Against Women, our paradigms, our history would say that our paradigms are predominantly white, for white men and women forming strategies and those kinds of things. And so now we really see and experience moments where there are some real conflicts among women around, for example, the inclusion of men in this work. And white women, with good reason, have been, you know, wondering and distrustful to a real extent around what men would do when we got in there. You
mm-hmm.
know, are we going to go and take it over, or just what are we going to do? Meanwhile, women of color, and particularly African-American women right now, I think are really welcoming, inviting men from their communities to step in and join them in doing the work. So there's some real sort of tension among women in that regard, and it then means that for us as men, what is our role when women are having conflict?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we step in and try and take sides and consolidate our power, sort of a basic strategy? Or in this case, for example, if white women are not listening to women of color and, in fact, using their privilege, white privilege, is it not then my responsibility to respectfully first locating my position and social location and position power, saying it's a problem for me to step into this exchange, but then point out the racism that's really getting in the way of something really beginning to happen in the room around figuring out how and whether men can participate?
Mm-hmm.
Rambled on there. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, this is perfect because what you're really highlighting goes right back to TERF number one of the overarching ones, acknowledging potential TERF issues up front. And you mentioned two huge ones, race and working as men in women's territory.
Yeah, and I think they really are tough and critical to deal with because they do mix, you know, they potentially become those character kind of things, or ego kind of things, or what right have you got to tell me this kind of things, as opposed to simply, gee, there's different positions. And, you know, and it is, you know, you're describing basically the navigation. I'm not sure there's always a right answer, but it's very important to be very strategic about what the answers are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank both Dick and Wendy, and now I want to open it up. We have about 10 minutes. I want to open up the phone lines so that we can hear from all of you out there. If you have questions that you'd like to ask either Wendy or Dick or Larry or myself, please raise your hand.
And I know, operator, if you can open the phone lines of Allison Bassinger had a question before, Noelle Duckworth, Nicole Matthews-Creech, and Michelle Dodds, and if any of them may still want to go back to the questions they had before. And anyone else, please raise your hands. Let me ask you, Dick. Noelle had a question before. Noelle, is your line open yet? Anyone's line open yet?
I'm sorry, was it Noelle?
Hi. Noelle Duckworth.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Nope.
Hi, Noelle.
Hi. My question was, when you mentioned consensus, it was interesting because I got an email from a group that talks about communication styles, and it came across today that said that consensus is one of the most least effective methods to use. And it's an email that goes out mainly to business communities, but when you talked about it in the presentation, it resonated. I disagree with that, but I just wanted to know what evidence is out there around consensus. So if we have people making the argument that it's the most least effective, how we can talk about that.
You know, I don't actually know what the evidence is. I think that my notion, and then I'd love to hear from Dick and Wendy, my notion that, you know, kind of defining consensus in the way I did, which is, gee, we can all live with it, I heard and learned from someone else, and it's just, you know, in my years of coalition experience, that's a lot stronger than the notion that consensus means everyone needs to work through and agree on things. Just because the coalition's a tool to get things done, and we can not get things done if we spend all our time in focusing on just one decision or getting everyone happy. But I'm wondering, Dick, whether what your experience is and what any implications you may have.
Well, I don't have much to say on that. We try to sort of work in a non-hierarchical structure, and we, you know, I could just say that my personal experience and consensus work has just been exhausting. And, you know, there comes the moment where someone will say, well, this is really important, but there are women getting injured, if not killed, out there, and we're in our second or third day of not being able to make this decision. So I don't know. I have found it exhausting as a process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the hotter the issue is, the more the consensus is a concern.
Even from Prevention Connection, I think there's also a difference between consensus in running an organization and consensus around a coalition, and that in a coalition, we really need to be able to find a common ground, and that in organizations, there's certain decisions that need to be made in certain contexts, and there's other decisions that need to have a buy-in of everyone, and that in a coalition, it's really essential to get that voice involved of everyone, and that I think So in a business community that's maybe looking specifically at their own organization, it might be very different.
Yeah, and I think also like defining, there may be different levels of decision. You know, there's certain decisions about policy that could threaten a specific organization. There are political decisions, and then there are just how do we get along decisions that have different, you know, perhaps different levels of agreement. Operator, could you open Gwen Federico's phone and also Allison's if it's not open? Wendy, anything you want to add on the consensus issue?
Well, I just think, you know, I want to echo that it takes time, but usually it's worth it because then you have everybody's buy-in and everybody's cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, ma'am. Mr. Lee, was that Allison?
Allison Bassinger. Yeah.
Bassinger, okay. Ms. Federico, you can go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, hello. I'm just wondering, as my agency, we're a domestic violence sexual assault dual agency, looking towards coalition building and finding stakeholders and engaging them, and I'm just wondering what the fundamental differences are in the language of using a task force or an alliance in building this coalition.
Well, I mean, I'll respond unless either of our guests have a response. Dick or Wendy?
I don't.
Wendy?
Well, our I probably mentioned it, that ours is called a task force, and I've actually been sort of talking with people about changing the name because I don't really like that. It sounds very militaristic to me almost. And there are some groups around the country that are that have changed those kinds of names to things that are like an acronym that spells something positive, and it doesn't even have task force, coalition, alliance, or anything in it. It has words like, you know, preventing violence kinds of words. And, you know, so then they're really talking about what they're doing and not who, you know, not some kind of name like that.
Yeah. Gwen, if you want to have more kind of technical background, you can go to our 8 Steps for Effective Coalition paper or perhaps to one of the earlier web forums. The paper is just on preventioninstitute.org under tools. And one of the points we make is there's probably about 8 different names. There's alliance, there's task force, there's coalition, there's collaborative, several others. But one of the most important things to do is people understand is people often use these terms somewhat interchangeably and, you know, and may have different meanings. 3 people will have different meanings from the same term. So the term in and of itself won't solve the problem. But, you know, a task force, perhaps I hadn't thought about the militaristic association. I think of it as maybe in some ways positive because it's really emphasizing this as something very specific to get done. Coalition might be something that's a bit broader. An action group or a working group might be more specific or more narrow. You know, those are some of the characteristics to think of.
And those often come as subgroups to the larger coalition, you know, smaller dyads and triads, as we mentioned earlier, who are actually tasked with moving a specific item forward.
Yeah, we have time probably just for one more question, unfortunately. But I'd love to, if we can, hear from Allison Bassinger. Allison, if your line is open.
Okay, 1 moment from Ms. Bassinger. Okay, Ms. Bassinger, please proceed with your question.
Okay, first of all, I just wanted to say thank you for catching our question and for inviting us to ask it. And thank you for all of the great suggestions. It's been a really positive webinar.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, our issue is, as kind of ground-level advocates, we've really noticed that collaboration can be a really, really positive thing in talking to other agencies and other ground-level people. But we really aren't in the place to initiate those conversations. So how can we get that moving if maybe the power is not in our hands?
You stumped us now.
Oh no.
Dick, any comments you'd like to make at that point?
No, I'm going to pass. I'm not sure I completely understood the question, so I'm going to pass.
It sounds like the question is that there's some groups that maybe have more status or more hierarchy. And, you know, if you're not the ED, you don't have the power, you may not have the power either at the coalition meeting or really even to fully represent your organization. Needless to say, those are all very real, and we have to be realistic about when we can, when we can't. speak, how much we speak, what we say, et cetera. At the same time, I really want to emphasize that we're all in this work because we're really caring about outcome. And I think there are ways to use your vision, to use your creativity about outcome, to use your insistence that we're there to make the right decisions and to achieve important results as kind of the voice that you use.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you can recontextualize in terms of what the work is all about, I won't say it gives you the same level of power as someone, quote, more powerful, but it certainly can enhance your work. And I really think it also sets a tone then that, wait a minute, we're all contributing here. We all have something to offer. Because as someone wrote in the text chat, you know, a coalition is really different from a business. It's not a hierarchy. You know, and we all do have, although there obviously are power differentials, we all do have both the opportunity and the responsibility to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Larry. And thanks for all of your questions, Allison, and was it Noel? And I also want to thank one more time Wendy and Dick for joining us for today's web forum. Their experiences demonstrate that even when people work collaboratively, that there are going to be issues of turf. And if turf isn't a problem in your work now, it could be in the future. So Wendy and Dick, thank you both for joining us and talking through some of the issues that you've worked through and how you've worked through them.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, and we hope that both their very real and I think extraordinarily valuable kind of, you know, quick and dirty explanation of their experience really, you know, are going to make TURF more manageable for you, and I hope you'll be communicating with us and let us know that you know, as it moves forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, we hope that all the tips that we've been able to share with you today are, as Larry said, going to help you address these issues more manageably. Most often, individuals join a coalition because they believe in the reason that the coalition was formed. And the value of bringing together different perspectives to work on a common issue should never, ever be underestimated. In fact, that's what prevents stagnant thinking and facilitates comprehensive solutions. So we hope that you're able to use these concepts in your own work and in your own communities, and we highly encourage you to read the supplemental material, The Tension of TURF, Making It Work for the Coalition, that's available on CalCASA's website. So I'm going to sign off now for myself, and...
And it's been a pleasure, Liz. Thanks so much for making this happen. And David, we'll turn it over to you. You've really... you know, really created a virtual turf-free community for us here to really talk about some hard issues.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Larry and Liz, and thank you, Dick and Wendy, for a wonderful conversation. And you should see on your screen our evaluation. Please fill out the evaluation. This is very important for us, and we use this in being able to shape our Prevention Connection web conferences and other Prevention Connection activities. Our next web conference, we are likely to be doing a repeat, an encore performance of this one, so you can around TURF. So go ahead and when you hear about that, forward that quickly to your peers so they can attend the session. And also we will be having on July 10th another web conference looking at service delivery organizations doing prevention work and some of the issues around that collaboration and TURF once again revisiting us. So I'd like to thank you for joining today's web conference. The text chat will be available on the Prevent Connect website. The slides are there now. You can download those. We will have a recording available, and we will send you all an email once when that is available. So thank you all for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you on the web in the future. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact myself, me, and get information. And we look forward to you doing more exciting work around ending violence against women. So we will now end the audio portion of the presentation. This will stay on for about 10 minutes for you to complete your evaluation. Thank you, and I will now hand this back to the operator.
Thank you. This concludes the Prevention Connection web conference call. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for participating. You may all disconnect.